Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I am Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And we are... It's host alone or host together, whatever. It's just us, no guests today. So we get to experience minute 19, which is all about sparks and turning knobs and all kinds of stuff. But Hal, fill us in on what's going on.
Well, it's a lot of sparks, knobs, and percentages. Back to you, Jim.
Thank you. A little more detail, please.
Okay. Yes. The minute 19 synopsis. In the Hydra laboratory, the air thrums with tension as Dr. Arnim Zola, his hands steady despite his nerves, carefully inserts the glowing tesseract into the heart of his machine. The device whirs to life, gauges flickering. 20%, Zola announces, his voice taut. 40, 60, stabilizing at 70%. Johann Schmidt, his presence dominating the cold metallic room, steps closer, his eyes gleaming with ruthless ambition. I have not come all this way for safety, Doctor, he snaps, reaching for the controls. With a decisive twist, he pushes the machine to its maximum and a surge of blue lightning crackles through the chamber, illuminating the walls with an eerie glow. And here we are.
What a minute.
It's like we're
there.
Knobs and,
Wait a minute. Yeah.
Exactly.
Wow. But yeah, also, and you know, it's funny. This is the first of two big knob things, and that's going to come up in about 10 minutes. And it's like this... We're watching, like you said, percentages and knobs. And it's always fascinating how much that takes up. It takes up a lot of your mind space watching these things. It's great drama too. You know where 100% is.
I spent some time studying the knobs and switches. And as I'll comment again when we get to Howard Stark's lab, the set designers and art directors did just a fantastic job of building this retrofuturistic scientific world. No machines ever looked like these machines, but they look like they belong in this era.
Right. Yeah, they absolutely do. And, you know, it's so tactile. And, you know, I think if this were set in modern times, it would be, you know, somebody staring at a computer screen with some operating system that's never existed, and they would be typing, you know, 300 words a minute for some reason about something, but it works so much better here when you have a knob and we're easing it up and you see the difference between Zola, and then Schmidt just goes and cranks it up. And Jim, like you said, we don't really know. We can't really explain exactly what's going on, but we know that, you know, 100 is bigger than 70. So I guess we should stand back and look out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that dial has nothing but numbers on it. As far as I can see, I mean,
Well, they know.
Yeah, they know what it is. Yeah.
There's a little bit of Frankenstein's laboratory in here. There's some Metropolis, the Fritz Lang Metropolis.
Oh, yes.
There's some Bat Cave, too.
There's some Bat Cave. Right. Absolutely, there's some Bat Cave.
Yeah.
These are a few of my favorite things.
Yeah, and there's also a little bit of the opera singer from Fifth Element. I mean, there's some of the cables. You can't tell if they're like electrical cables or if they're hydraulic cables or if they're, you know, some kind of air pressure hoses. They all seem to be the wrong thickness, but I guess it's right for them, just being able to pump all that tesseract energy around.
Well, there's a nice moment in this minute that conjured a very specific memory for me, and I don't know if you guys have ever ridden the Indiana Jones Temple of Doom ride at Disneyland?
Oh yeah,
but you're
I once called that Indiana Jones and the Oh God My Back.
Yes,
that's how I felt coming off of that.
You're riding a Jeep, and there's a part near the start of the ride when you enter the Temple of Doom, and lightning crackles across the ceiling of the chamber you're in, and blue glow is kind of flashing all around you. And this scene felt so much like that to me. It was so evocative of that experience of riding this fake Jeep through this fake temple while lightning is flashing around you that I really enjoyed it.
I hadn't thought about that ride in a long time. But you're spot on.
Yeah, I do like the tactile nature of everything here. There's no touch screen. It's all gigantic toggle switches. You know, they're big double pull, double throw. You can feel the beads of solder stuck to the underside of that circuit board. And it's probably gigantic, you know, 6GH8A vacuum tubes powering inside that box in front of Dr. Zola.
Oh, I love it when you show off, Jim.
It's my Radio Shack history.
Tell me more about vacuum tubes, Jim. And it's interesting, too. And, you know, it's no surprise. And we certainly know, you know, from Joe and the types of people he work with, you know, the attention to detail. But it still makes me smile knowing that we can go through this with this level of scrutiny that we have and scrubbing through minutes, you know, second by second, back and forth and back and forth, and just see that in these simple, quick shots of the toggle switches you're talking about, you know, the labels are in German. And, yep, you know, it's nonsense. And, you know, it could have just had X's or something on it. But, you know, there, as you said, Brian, you're complimenting the set design. And, yeah, there was a set designer and a prop master who said, no, you know, someday someone's going to pause the Blu-ray or the 4K UHD and they're going to zoom in. And so we're going to make sure that it's right, even if you might miss it in passing, even on the big screen.
Yeah. It feels right. If you build it right, it'll feel right. Even if the audience doesn't get the detail, they'll get the verisimilitude of the thing.
Exactly. Yeah. You can go from Alf to Zoo on the toggle switch. So it's like, yes, they got the German right. But yeah, it feels so good that, you know, they did pretty much everything except, put in some kind of circuitry, you know, circuit breakers or fuses or something to block all this blue energy. And actually, that's where I'd like to talk a little bit about circuit breakers. It's funny, before this episode, I knew nothing about circuit breakers, so I had to go out and scan the entire internet to teach myself, you know, where did circuit breakers come from and how do they work and all that jazz. And
I just want to get this straight. A guy who knows serial numbers of vacuum tubes did not know until now how circuit breakers work.
I never sold circuit breakers at Radio Shack. I'm sorry, I'm strictly a tube guy. We had all the tube
recount.
We had the tube tester guys every Saturday morning with a big grocery bag full of tubes that they popped out of their Zenith, and they'd spend the whole day. And then we play Go Fish at the sales counter because they go, "You got any 2D2s? No, no. How about an 8H? No, you know." So we. And then we, you know, special order. Can you call another store? So
a super quick question about that Radio Shack experience, Jim. Was there any crossover between the tube tester guys? Were any of them members of the Battery Club?
They all were members of the Battery Club.
And they cherished my membership in that Battery Club. Walk in there once a month, drop your card down, and you get a battery.
They were there on the first of the month, no matter what.
That's
and you get and the smart ones always went for the 9 volts because those are the most expensive.
Right.
So you know pick up those, and that's why we gave away those free flashlights with the slot for 5D batteries. So if you want it, if you get the free flashlight and you get your free battery, but you have to wait another, you know, 4 more months to get the rest of them.
Anyway, I'm sorry. You wanted to talk about circuit breakers.
They were clever. Yeah, we can talk about circuit breakers. It's funny that, you know, of course, one of the things that, you know, where this would have to be invented would be by some, you know, some mother of necessity. And that man was Thomas Edison. He actually patented the first circuit breakers after he patented the first fuse, when he started noticing that his dynamos could blow up if there was a short circuit or an overload. And there are the two ways. I did not know how an actual, like, it, well, he came up with the circuit breaker, but later on, it was perfected. The modern circuit breaker that we think of when you're in your house and, you know, your lights blow out and you go in, you have to go find out which of the little black squares is, you know, the switch is not pointing all the way over to the left. Those guys were, it's called a practical resettable miniature circuit breaker. And those guys were two Germans, as were happened to be. Oh, actually, I think they were they were German Swedish, and Hugo Stotz, with collaborator Heinrich Stockner, who worked at Brown Boveri and Company, which is the predecessor to ABB, the company ABB, which you've probably seen on.
Oh, sure.
Anytime you go to see a power substation or any, you might have ABB circuit breakers in your house. Anyway, they were patented in Germany in 1924, and then later in the U.S. in 27. It combined two features. One was thermal tripping, which if you'd have this low temperature metal that would melt if a lot of current went through it for an overload.
That's how a fuse works, right?
That's pretty much, yeah, except the right. difference with the circuit breaker is once it tripped, the metal would, it would overheat and liquefy, but then it would turn back. I'm not sure which, I should have looked up what metal it is. I'll leave that as an exercise for our listeners. But it was a low temperature metal that would melt and then break the circuit. And then once it cooled, it would solidify again and meet up, hopefully.
So it was reusable, unlike a
fuse. Right, yeah, exactly. And then the other way, which is a very clever thing, if you had a short circuit, a direct short circuit, it relied on magnetism. It had a coil around, I'm using my hands and I'm talking on an audio. Okay.
I'll interpret for
yes.
you.
Yes, what Jim's doing.
Jim is twirling his yeah. index finger.
Yeah,
if you could pick an intriguing way.
Picture two parallel wires and a coil circles both of them. A coil circles one of them, and the static one has a spring attached to it. So what happens with the coil that's wrapped around it? So if a circuit's flowing normally, there's no magnetic field. If there's a short circuit, the current flows back along the coil, magnetizes around the metal wire, and pulls it away, pulls it away from the other metal and breaks the circuit, and that will it's held by a spring. So when you as anybody that sees a circuit breaker, you have to turn it off, which moves it moves the spring back into its neutral position, and then when you push it back into position to on, you're arming the spring, and it kind of like puts it back on a hook. That's why there's that second position after a circuit breaker has been tripped. I never knew it was magnetism. I always thought it was something to do with heat. Yeah. So there's probably wonderful videos of how all this works on YouTube. So I'd suggest rather than picturing me waving my arms around, artistic though it may seem, the best thing to do is go to YouTube and ask, how do circuit breakers work? But that's something that you learn in this very minute.
It's funny, Jim, that brought to mind I guess this is my only circuit breaker story, which is not a good one, but it's not very long.
So everybody should have one.
Everybody's got to have at least one. I'm thinking about buying some new ones from somebody. But so in flying, it was part of before start the engine or pre takeoff checklist, depending on where you are. You're looking over the instrument panel and you've got a whole list of things, and you see airline pilots with their flow and their hands are moving around, kind of like Jim's were recently, flipping switches and things like that. In a typical airplane like a Cessna 172, that electrical system is protected by a row of circuit breakers. And it's a horizontal row toward the bottom of the instrument panel, and there's little round discs. And if the circuit breaker is tripped, they will pop out. And I was always taught, and I believe in this method, you don't just look at it. So you can look at it and you could see pretty easily if one of them had tripped. But as a habit and as part of my flow, I would sort of put my knuckle there and just run it across all of them. Just run my hand across this area at the bottom of the panel, make sure nothing was sticking out. And that's just a tactical way to really reinforce in my head. Yes, nope, none of the circuit breakers are tripped. Well, I got a check out fairly recently in an RV-12 that is all glass cockpit. It's a completely different electrical system, although in a similar spot on the panel, that's where they're protected, but they're the plastic sort of plug-in fuses. I don't know what the term is. Maybe you do. So not your traditional glass cylinder with the metal on each end, but that little plastic plugs that go in. And so the instructor is just teaching me the ins and outs of this particular airplane. And I get to the part where I'm supposed to check all the fuses, and I look, and then I reach down and just drag my hand across this row of things just out of force of, decades of habit. And then I start to move on to the next thing. And he's just staring at me. He starts to smirk. And I said, what? And he said, well, what do you think happens when one of these fuses blows? I said, oh, it doesn't move. It doesn't magically pop out or anything at all, does it? It just sits there. And he said, yep. And I said, I'm still just going to run my hand across even though it's meaningless. And he said, that's fine. You know, that's fine. We'll move on. But anyway, getting used to circuit breakers versus fuses is all part of, you know, flying a different kind of airplane.
Wow. Now I feel bad. I don't have a circuit breaker story.
Mine was longer than I thought it would be and not very good. So yeah. Quit while you're ahead, Brian.
Yeah, I forfeit my time to you, sir.
I'm sorry. It was not worth it.
I did have a thought on storytelling in this minute, because I operating under the idea that no bit of dialogue is wasted. Everything's there for a purpose. I thought about the character building here between Zola and Schmidt. Zola's more cautious. Zola wants to stop at 70%. Schmidt says, no way, we're turning up to 100. And that's a dynamic that's going to define these two men as they go through the movie. Right. Zola's going to be cautious. Zola thinks he's working for Hitler. Schmidt's going to be... Schmidt's got his own program, his own plan. Right. It doesn't necessarily have anything to do with Hitler. So we got a little foreshadowing here of friction between the two men, of who's the boss and who's the lackey, and how this is going to turn out for both of them. That I think is... You know, it's they're laying a little groundwork here, and I appreciate that.
Absolutely, and Zola would hate it. I mean, he would be quite scared of overdoing it and
yeah.
You know, sort of wrecking everything and things like that. And I suspect that so Schmidt comes in. I didn't come here for safety. He cranks it up to 11. If the whole thing had blown up and the Tesseract was destroyed. I don't think Schmidt's taking the blame for it. I think Zola's going down for it under those circumstances.
Well, and you notice that Zola puts on the safety goggles. Schmidt right, doesn't bother with safety goggles. Yeah, you're right. You're right. We know who's taking the fall for this. But in his way, I think Zola's, he's trying to be a good scientist. He's mad. He's working for the wrong team, but he's trying to be a good scientist about this. Well, we'll try 70. That looks about right. You know, we got it dialed in. Schmidt's not having any of it.
Nope.
No, he wants results. Not answers, not excuses, I think is the only
thing. Yeah. Yes, exactly.
I was just getting back to circuit breakers briefly.
I know
we're talking about the movie, but let's get it. One of the biggest circuit breaker stories I can think of happened during the Apollo days.
Yeah. I didn't want to go there, but go ahead.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, we always wind up in space. It's okay.
I got my pen cap ready, Jim.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. What Brian is referencing is back in Apollo 14, as they were orbiting the moon, about to descend to the lunar surface, the crew of Apollo 14, most notably Al Shepard, was having a problem where the abort switch, which would, you know, fire off the ascent stage of the lunar module and pretty much end the lunar landing like that, the abort push button switch had some kind of a piece of solder or something bouncing around inside of it. And it would short out, it would simulate a push button press, like somebody had pressed the abort button. And so it kept shorting it out and knocking out the circuit breaker. And so before they started on their power descent, PDI, the power descent, the guidance computer kept reporting, I'm getting an abort signal. Are you sure? Yes or no? And so they had they went around another orbit while they tried to figure it out. If they went on to PDI, the computer wasn't going to ask, are you sure? It would say, oh, we got to get out of here. And then that would end the mission. So the ground controllers, there was a software program named Don Iles, and he was the hero, really, of Apollo 14, doesn't get enough credit. They developed an emergency software patch that they uploaded from Houston to the moon and instructed the crew, who was Al Shepard and Ed Mitchell. They told them to enter this custom code into the guidance computer. They had to sit there and type in. There's two parts of each line. It's a noun and a verb. So they had to go over like 20 or 30 lines of code and say, you know, if, then, else, and all this. But tell them, ignore the abort button. If we want to abort, we're going to go a different route. Here's, you know, watch if this and this happens, then it's an abort. But otherwise, just pay no attention to that abort button on the panel. And the fix worked, and they managed to land Antares, the lunar module, on the moon, thanks to being able to override a circuit breaker.
Now, Jim, I thought you were going in an entirely different direction with that story.
Oh, okay. What?
I mentioned the pin because in Apollo 11, when Aldrin was getting back to the lunar module, he banged his backpack into the
Right.
circuit module panel, into the circuit breaker panel, snapped off a switch on the circuit breaker. And so here's Armstrong and Aldrin on the moon with a broken switch on the circuit breaker panel. And Aldrin picks up a pin and says, "Well, I think that'll fit in there." And he jams it into the hole of the broken switch and solved the problem with a pin. And they lifted off the moon and everything ended happily. But
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. Yeah, there's yet another, and that's New
now I
Jersey.
have a circuit breaker story.
Yeah, good job, Brian. Yeah, I mean it's obvious New Jersey ingenuity. Thanks, Dr. Aldrin. And yeah, this is what you have to do when you're 230,000 miles from the nearest Radio Shack. So,
It all comes around. It all
yeah,
comes
it
around.
absolutely does.
Oh
I miss
boy.
Radio Shack.
Yeah.
It
It was a good time, but
yeah.
it's
The brand still exists in some form, I think, but
it's back. It's at CES as we're speaking. The
oh,
Consumer
really?
Electronics Show is going on in Vegas, and they've announced a big comeback. It's a whole new company. It's not a Tandy Corporation,
Okay.
but they are back, and they're beautiful.
Wow.
So,
Well.
It was a great place to work. I learned a lot about electronics, and I didn't learn anything about circuit breakers, but I did learn how. That was my first retail job, and you learn what people would get upset about. I had a manager there, and he said, "What you have to remember is when people come in with a return, everything we sell here is a toy, and these people are upset because their toys are broken. So you have to treat them like folks with broken toys, and just
Yes.
show some compassion." So it's like that's what I learned from Radio Shack, the compassion of somebody who had a 220-piece electronic set, couldn't figure out why the springs fell off. But maybe someday somebody will bring back Radio Shack, and they'll be in a shopping center near you. Fingers
Well,
crossed.
they got to bring back shopping centers first.
That's
That's
true.
yeah.
Wow.
And you mentioned
Well,
that 220 piece electronics thing. We were talking about those just recently, but those 50 in one, 60 in one, 200 in one, or whatever, those boxes with the wooden frame and all the spring
they were so
connectors.
great.
I loved that thing so much. And
Yep.
you build something, you connect the wires. Okay, now I've built a radio. And then you take it all apart. Now I've built a siren or an alarm
Well, and I just scavenged those for years. I'd have drawers full of little light bulbs and springs and switches
Oh,
that
wow.
I ripped out of those boards and just used for other stuff.
Where can I get a 220K resistor? Oh wait, it's right here. It's in row three.
So Brian, when somebody comes up to you with a tesseract, you're ready, is what I'm hearing you say.
I got the gear. Let's
You're all set.
put it in and turn it up to 100, see what happens.
Yes. Don't never stop at 70. That's the rule.
Exactly.
Wow.
Oh my
Well,
gosh.
this has been an illuminating, as it were, minute. But
Electrifying, I
I let,
dare
oh
say.
wow, yes, it's
I'm gonna hate myself.
well, no, you're not here for safety.
Right. I definitely didn't come here for safety. I'm not sure what I came here for, but not that.
Ah, wow. Well, we'll be back with lots more in minutes to come. As we're gonna start on the 20 series of minutes. So get ready for that. But anyway, thanks everybody out there for joining us. If you'd like to continue the conversation, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like the show, don't forget to subscribe, leave a like. If you could leave a review too, because a lot of times if people see a review, they're more likely to come and listen to us. And if the more reviews that you have, the higher we wind up in their, the Apple podcast algorithms. So we do appreciate if you could leave a like and a review at whatever podcast streaming service you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And please be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
can do this all day.